This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Jack Ravenwood. Jack, it's great talking to you.
Hello. Thanks a lot for having me on the show.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
It's nice talking to you, Jack.
You too.
Jack, you have a book called Paradise Theater. It's a collection of short stories, but it's based on your experience growing up in a small town in Wisconsin in the 1980s, and it also deals with a lot of cultural, economic, and political themes.
Yeah, that's right. The book is called Paradise Theater. It's called Paradise Theater, and it's named after an old movie house that used to exist in my hometown.
That's interesting. I Googled the name and an album for Styx came up. I was thinking you named it after that because they use a kind of image of like an old school movie theater on their album.
No, actually, I didn't even know that that album existed until I was searching to see if anybody else already had a book with this title. But the movie house was one of my favorites when I was a kid. They used to show old movies from anywhere from the 30s to the 50s. Especially old monster movies. And so my friends and I really liked that, and you could go and watch them for 99 cents. And so I used it just as a kind of a symbol of, you know, going back and looking at things from the past.
Does that place still exist?
The building still exists. The theater closed down, I think, in the 1990s, and now it's actually some kind of church. I don't know what denomination, but it was vacant for the longest time. And then finally somebody bought it and they turned it into a church.
So, Jack, I'm looking over your book on Little A Press, and you have a lot of cool photographs from West Dallas. You have the one in the book cover of the Paradise Theater, but you also have this like old postcard from the early 20th century. Then you have this mural. And then you have some like cool sort of like a mid-century like road signage, like the one that says Fairview Motors Quality Cars.
Yeah, anybody who lives in West Dallas, I think, knows that sign. And I have been seeing it for as long as I've been alive. It's at this intersection of, I think it's like 55th and Beloit Street. And it's always looked exactly the same for as long as I can remember. And it just has this quality of sort of like the only constant thing in a changing environment. And I've always loved the aesthetics of it, so I had to include a picture of that. I also have it featured on the back cover of my book on the print edition.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the Madonna Inn sign. It's a place in California. It's this cool like 50s hotel that I've done a lot of paintings of. But it's kind of same style.
Yeah, I love a lot of the architecture and signage and everything from that era. I don't know if it's just because it's old now and it has a certain character to it or what, but it's just, I like it better than a lot of what gets made today.
What do you think about a lot of the like vintage Vegas kind of stuff? Have you been to Vegas?
I was there once when I was a kid, but from what I can remember, the vintage stuff, like from the 50s and 60s and even the 70s, yeah, I like it. I mean, it's got a kind of absurd flavor to it, but, you know, that's kind of cool sometimes. So, I mean, all of Las Vegas has an absurd flavor to it. It's a, you know, town built around gambling. But, I prefer that old stuff, you know, from back in the days when Sinatra and the Rat Pack were playing there every Friday night to the stuff that they're doing now, which is just, you know, it's more high tech, but it just seems to not have as much warmth or character to it.
About West Dallas, was it famous for Jeffrey Dahmer?
Yeah, it's got a handful of, you know, sort of footnotes in history.
I think Liberace was also from there.
He was, yeah. So we got those two guys and very little else. There was a guy who won some Olympics, won gold medals in the Olympics years back. I think he was an ice skater or something who was from there. And it's just a very kind of typical small town that grew up around a factory. And so I guess one of the reasons why I wanted to write about it, aside from the fact that it's my hometown, is that I feel like what happened to West Allis happened to so many other small towns and cities around the country. And those stories have been ignored for a long time. Although I just read the other day that apparently the bestseller right now is a book called Hillbilly Elegy by a guy, I think his name is Vance, and he seems to be writing about something very similar, like his upbringing. And he grew up in the Appalachian area, but kind of similar thing, like a factory town, the factory closes, and the culture and the economy and everything else just goes into a steady decline.
It was pretty economically decimated by jobs going overseas in the 90s. It's interesting because I was doing some research on Google Maps, and it looked, I'd say, pretty kind of a generic kind of middle-class suburban area, but it looked somewhat prosperous, so maybe it's rebounded since then.
It's possible. I have not lived there for a long time, so I couldn't really say what's going on in the town right now. The town is West Allis, which is a little first-ring suburb of Milwaukee, and it grew up around a factory complex called Allis Chalmers, and Allis Chalmers made tractor parts. And I think they also used some of their facilities to make some of the Fat Man and Little Boy bombs that they dropped on Japan during the Second World War. So that's a little piece of history that they participated in. But mainly it was just a very typical factory town. And, you know, the most of the men in the community, I think, worked for this factory. And then sometime in the 1970s through the 80s, production declined. And by the time, I think, 1985 or 1988, somewhere in there, everything was completely closed. And so one of the things that I grew up around is basically the decline of a city that used to rely on manufacturing jobs, which then lost those manufacturing jobs and nothing else really came in to replace them. The first business that I remember coming in after the factory closed was a Blockbuster Video. And looking back now, I thought, you know, well, that's great. You know, you can't have a living wage anymore, but you can watch TV and...
Now Blockbusters have gone the same way due to, like, Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that's the nature of the economy, right? I mean, I was out with the old and with the new.
That's kind of the theme in your book, is you have all these personal stories of people who are out of work, and you talk about things like drug addiction. And is one of the kids, there's a character named Jack. Is that character based on you?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, with some artistic liberties taken, but yeah.
And there are political themes because he's very kind of idealistic, and he gets into arguments with his father, and he goes on some political tangent where he says, His dad tells him that you have to have a vision, like you have to become like a lawyer or something. And he says he's very idealistic, and he says, I don't want to be one of those I forget how you word it, but I don't want to be one of those like destructive people in society.
Yeah, basically, which is pretty much the way that I was when I was about 20 years old or so, just looking around and feeling like as many sort of adolescents do, you know, oh, the world is corrupt and everybody's just out to make money and scam and nobody cares about any higher values. And so I felt really depressed when I was that age, looking around and seeing that and just feeling like the world was entirely based on economics and there wasn't much in the way of higher values in the world. And I guess I still kind of have that conclusion. Hopefully I've become a little more practical as I've gotten older, but I think that observation is basically sound, at least for the modern West.
Or it seems like it's rather how long has that economic lie have been talking about? You know, everyone assumes that we're in a Socratic world when everything has pre-Socratic values under a hypocritical free market society. You know, they seem to push along this narrative and institutions don't have power over you. I kind of see the same observations as well. You might as well not go to college and be a porn star or something.
Yeah, the whole going to college thing, I think if I could go back, maybe I would do that differently and just not go. And certainly any young person that I meet now, if they're asking me about going to college, that's the first thing I tell them is why. You're just going to incur debt. You're going to get a largely worthless education. and you'll be the worse in 4 years. Whereas if you go out into the world with a little bit of creativity, you can get some experience, either job experience or just life experience. And at least, even if it doesn't lead to anything, at least you're not going to go into debt for it.
It's more like a socioeconomic, not per se a scam, but a socioeconomic classist thing, where if you have $100,000 laying around and the institution wants it, you give it to them, and then you have a class, you know, bachelor's degree on your forehead, and it seems to be this protocol.
And it's one thing if you have a very clear career objective, like if you want to become a doctor, you obviously have to go to medical school. But the notion that you just have to go to college just for the sake of getting a bachelor's degree or a degree just for the sake of it.
It's an upper middle class value compared to if you're middle class, you don't care about that stuff. But the upper middle class, I've realized, according to Paul Fussell's class, the upper middle class tends to focus on trying to be an aristocratic value people. And so they LARP and role play as these powerful people, but in reality the upper class is decadent and depraved because they have all this money in the world and nobody wants to uphold society. And so it's the upper middle class as overeducated and are dupes that believe there's some kind of LARPy gods or something.
One of the things that I've noticed with the university system is that the more they let more and more people in, the more that they embrace this idea that everyone should go to college, the more everything gets dumbed down. And so people who have an intellectual predisposition, who want to study, let's say, serious philosophy or serious literature, don't really have the opportunity to do that anymore unless you're going to a really selective private school. But if you go to a regular university like I did, you're going to get a combination of, SJW politics and then just really dumbed down analysis that doesn't get to the heart of any of those
things. And you're spending money on it and you should be deserved.
Yeah.
You know, that's even more. I know the same thing. And especially if it's a racial background, say if you have a largely African-American or black and you teach a white professor, they won't understand it because they're not adapted to that. And there's this whole racial difference. And so it's sad, really. It's like you just have to pretend and lie, and it's retarded.
With the whole issue of this manufacturing jobs going overseas, that was a big issue brought up in the recent election. But how aware were you back when NAFTA was being proposed and Ross Perot was speaking out against that?
I was in high school at that time, and it's funny, most people today don't remember Ross Perot even being around, but yeah, he was the one presidential candidate at that time who was speaking out against NAFTA and said, you know, like, oh, if this passes, you're going to hear a giant sucking sound of jobs leaving the country. And of course, he was right, and that's exactly what's happened since then. And Trump, I thought, was remarkable for being the first presidential candidate, major presidential candidate, to acknowledge that fact. Everybody has been pretending that NAFTA worked basically for the last 20 years.
And with the Trump on trade deals, how optimistic are you with Trump? I know some people are disappointed with him. I mean, he did kill that Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was a big deal. But I know with the whole situation in North Korea, like he's been instigating that conflict with North Korea. And now like we're becoming more dependent on China to help stabilize that. So then Trump has to kind of give China a lot of leverage on trade.
Yeah, as far as how optimistic I am, I don't know. When he was first elected, based on some of the things that he was saying, I felt cautiously optimistic. I'm kind of cynical about politicians in general, so I didn't want to get sucked into believing in everything that he was saying. It was hard not to get caught up in the enthusiasm, but it's still a little too early to tell. I'm not happy with the war situation, but at the same time, I don't really know what's going on. It seems like they're doing this thing in Syria, but really it's to send a message to the North Koreans and to make the Chinese think something. And all of this, 4D chess or whatever they call it. And I'm just waiting to see what happens. You know, I'm an outsider looking, trying to look in. So we'll see. One of the things that I hope can happen is a better trade deal between China and the United States. I live in China now. I've lived here for the last 5 years. And so I've seen on the ground what the trade situation is here. And the trade imbalance that they talked about during the campaign, during the election, is absolutely real. You go into any store in America, whether it's Walmart or even something higher up, and probably 90% of everything on the shelves is made in China. In contrast, it's very difficult to get foreign-made products, U.S.-made products here in China. But because they have a middle class that's grown up over the last 10 or 15 years, there's increasing demand for those products. So what I hope will happen is that they will work out some kind of trade agreement between the Chinese and the Americans that basically makes both sides happy. The Chinese want foreign-made products. They're a little hard to get right now. America wants to make products again. And that is a situation that is just, you know, that they can work something out, I hope.
Yeah, maybe the best case scenario is we still buy like the really cheap junk at Walmart from China, but the middle class from China, like, we can carve out a kind of niche of creating more high-end manufacturing the way that Japan does or Germany does.
Yeah, that would be great. I know people there are complications to this issue. The first objection that I usually hear people raise is automation. You know, technology being what it is now, so many of the old factory jobs could be done by robots, and factories aren't going to want to hire people when they can just buy a robot. So I those issues will have to be worked out. And also, it's not just China now. Even China's manufacturing is increasingly moving to other third world countries like Vietnam or Indonesia. They're focusing on being more high-tech manufacturing now. So those products that are on the shelves at Walmart in 10 or 15 years, maybe they won't be made in China. Maybe they'll be made somewhere else.
So the state Wisconsin, that was one of the crucial states in the election. It was a state that's traditionally lean Democrat, and you had all these working-class white swing voters who traditionally voted Democrats or lean Democrat and voted for Trump. Was the town you grew up in one of those examples?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I don't know if they leaned Democrat. Probably it was kind of an even split. I think that the white working class in general tends to have more conservative values, but the ones who vote Democratic do so because Democrats have traditionally been thought of as the party that fights for the little guy. You know, I've heard that from people in my hometown many times. You know, I vote Democrat because they're the ones who are for the little guy. And, of course, that's just part of the image. And I think also the Republican Party has largely created an image for itself where they're the ones who are supposedly for traditional values. But when you look at the way their policies actually play out, that's not really the case at all. So American politics kind of has this absurd LARPing game where the Republicans are LARPing as traditional values people and the Democrats are LARPing as representing the little guy. And that's not true in either case.
And you have these kind of examples like Hillary Clinton refers to the white working class as deplorables. But there was some conservative pundit who said the white working class deserves to die.
I forget the guy's name. It was somebody in National Review. And there was a bit of a reaction to it at the time, and then it was just forgotten. But yeah, he wrote this article and he said, you know, these communities, they have so many problems, drug addiction and joblessness and everything. They just deserve
to die. It's Kevin Williamson.
Oh, okay. And I just thought, you know, what a callous attitude to take. And you could never say that about any other group, but you can say that about the white working class because basically they've been completely abandoned by both parties. And so that's one thing about Trump is I don't know yet how sincere he was or what's going to come of his presidency, but I understand exactly why he got the support that he got, because the things that he was saying, many people have been waiting to hear all their lives. Michael Moore said that. I remember there was a clip that was going around in the month or so before the election, about 5 minutes long or so, when he's saying Trump was the only one who went to a car factory in Michigan and told the owners that if you guys close this factory and ship these jobs overseas or to Mexico, I'm going to impose a 35% tariff on them and nobody's going to buy them. And everybody cheered, and because somebody should have been saying that all along. These jobs have been leaving for 20, 30 years now, and nobody has really done anything to try to resist it.
You mentioned that you discovered my blog both through the kind of political angle and the cultural angle.
We have a number of overlapping interests. I don't remember the first thing that I found. Let's see. I have a website that I write a lot of the content for. It's called MeanStreetCinema.com, and it's an overview of films that feature New York City in the 1970s and the 1980s. I grew up on a lot of those movies, watching them on cable TV. And
did you live in New York?
No, one of my best friends moved out there many years ago after high school, and so I visited a handful of times. But I'm an outsider looking in. It's mainly based on my love of those films from growing up with them, and just the look and feel of the city on film at that time. So I found your website. I know you interviewed a guy, I think his name is Robert Brenner, who does tours of the old Times Square. So that was a really interesting interview. And it seems like you interview people who are just all over the place politically, a lot of really unique ideas, and people who just wouldn't have much of a voice elsewhere. And I think that's awesome. So that's why I contacted you. I wonder how much is even left to see.
Yeah. When I interviewed Robert Brenner, he said, I mean, there's like the theaters, like the New Amsterdam are still there. They've been renovating.
I saw that yesterday.
There's like a few adult businesses left, but it's changed pretty dramatically. But I mean, I was just in downtown LA yesterday, and there's a lot of that kind of old gritty like urbanism. Even though it's being gentrified, it still has a lot of that.
Manhattan is pretty much the millionaire's backyard. It's like if you're living here, you're probably a millionaire, and this is what you do every day. You never leave the island, right? That's what it's now, the millionaire backyard, from rather that 1970s disgusting black afro street punk image that was very popular, you know, some decades ago. It's now the millionaire background, and it's quite friendly. That's my view on Manhattan.
Yeah, the last time I was there, that was definitely my impression too. It's like it's a lot cleaner and safer than it used to be, but there's an absence of culture, not entirely, but almost. But the funny thing about those old movies, like I grew up on them, and there's a certain allure to that time when the city was had a lot of problems and was in decay. But I don't think I would have wanted to actually live there. It's one of those things that is more interesting to look at from a distance.
Now it's like,
it's kind of like you had a interesting but dangerous area to like a safe and kind of a sterile.
Yeah, I think, which is often a pattern. You know, it's the people, poor people, artists or whatever, they create something and then other people are looking on and going, you know, oh, that's cool. I want to live there where the cool people are. And then they move in and then the prices go up and they kick out the very people that they wanted to live around. And then those people move somewhere else and make something new. And then the cycle just happens all over again. There's something similar happening near where I live. I live in a southern Chinese city called Shenzhen, which is right across the border from Hong Kong. And Hong Kong is a really great city, which in some ways reminds me of New York, actually, and just in terms of the feel of the place. I don't know, that might just be my subjective impression. But it's definitely the same as far as property values going sky high and people not really being able to afford to live there anymore. And so the changes that Manhattan and New York went through in the 1990s are something similar is happening here now. And the rent
is Shenzhen or Hong Kong?
In Hong Kong. In Shenzhen too, actually. But Shenzhen is still a lot more affordable by comparison.
You were telling me that Hong Kong, it has a lot of that, a lot of the neon signage that you would find in like the old New York.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's on my list of future projects to spend some time there taking photographs of it and either making a website or maybe a photo book or something, just while there's still enough of them there to photograph. But anybody who's into old signage, Hong Kong is a real treat.
I heard that even in Hong Kong, they're tearing a lot of that old stuff down and replacing them with the newer kind of electronic billboards.
They are, yeah. The ones, I was just there last week and I was thinking about this and looking at the different kinds of signs. And there are still a fair number of classic old neon signs, or at least that's what they look like to me. Then there are a lot of them that are, I don't know what you call them, but if you remember an old toy, I'm not sure. The other ones, do you remember an old children's toy called Light Bright?
Yeah.
Where you take these, you take these little like plastic pegs and you put them in a board and they light up.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the cheap signs that they have there are that kind of sign, whatever you call it.
Okay, yeah, they kind of like, I've seen them in like Asian cities, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And then the third kind of sign that I see in Hong Kong are, they're not neon or electronic at all, they're just painted. But they look like they have been sitting on this building since 1955 or something like that. There's a lot of older, the city, parts of it anyway, especially on the island, has a really old feel to it, especially compared to Shenzhen, because Shenzhen 30 years ago literally did not exist. Fastest growing city in the world. And it's 30 years ago, as the story goes, Deng Xiaoping, who was the leader of China at that time, pointed at a map and he pointed to the area just across the border from Hong Kong and he said, develop that. And so people went to work and they turned this little fishing village into a city of now I think it's 15 million people.
Yeah, just kind of comparing like Hong Kong to like the newer Chinese cities. Hong Kong has more of that, if you kind of describe as it's like an 80s cyberpunk aesthetic. I mean, that looks really cool. But the newer Chinese cities, they're futuristic, but they don't have that same aesthetic quality as Hong Kong does.
Yeah, comparing and contrasting Hong Kong and Shenzhen is really interesting to me because, so I live in Shenzhen, I often visit Hong Kong, and when you cross the border from Shenzhen into Hong Kong, somehow everything changes. The quality of the buildings is different, the construction is generally better. You're in a city that has a sense of history, even though it's not that long of a history. I mean, Hong Kong before it was a British colony wasn't really anything special. The British controlled it for 100 years and they did a lot to build it up into what it is today. But the culture is different because the people, it's kind of a bridge between East and West. It's a Chinese city, but there's always been a large expat community there. And English is one of the official languages, and so most anybody that you meet on the street will speak at least some English, which makes it a lot easier to get around in. And it's a much freer market, and so people in Shenzhen often go to Hong Kong just to be able to get products from the West that you can't get in China. And so, you know, you cross the border and as a Westerner, part of you feels like, you know, ah, civilization. I can get a decent meal and, you know, buy some groceries that I want to bring back to my place in Shenzhen. And it always makes me a little bit sad to cross the border back to Shenzhen. But Shenzhen has its own things going on. And I think even though it's not there yet, the two cities will continue to be on a par or will move towards being on a par with each other, which unfortunately will mean a little bit of decline for Hong Kong. Property values will keep going up. The city is going to come more and more under Chinese control because it's the 20th anniversary of the handover right now. For those who don't know, so there was a handover of Hong Kong from the British to the Chinese in 1997. And the way that was structured is that they have 50 years of relative autonomy, and they call that one country, two systems. And so there's 20 years that's passed, 30 years more to go. But what is happening over that time is that slowly Hong Kong is being absorbed into Greater China. Some of the political tensions that have happened over the last few years are a result of that. Hong Kong people tend to see themselves as Hong Kong people, whereas if you ask the average mainlander about Hong Kong, they will just say, oh, well, that's Chinese. That's a Chinese city like any other. But many people in Hong Kong feel that they have their own history, some of their own traditions. They have their own language. Most people in Hong Kong speak Cantonese. Most people in Shenzhen speak Mandarin, even though that's more of a northern language. But
that's
most
kind
people
of,
in Shenzhen.
Ironic because Hong Kong's much wealthier. I know in like California, among Chinese immigrants, Cantonese is seen as like more like working class Chinatown, and the wealthier suburban Chinatown seem to be more Mandarin. That seems my observation.
That's probably true. I don't know. And I'm guessing that's a recent development. As far as I know, in the old days, most of the Chinese immigrants would have come from Hong Kong because you could legally emigrate from there. And so that would have been Cantonese speakers. Then later you would have had some from Taiwan, and they speak, I don't know what it is exactly. I think it's not quite Mandarin, but it's much closer to Mandarin than it is to Cantonese. And then more recently, in the last 10 or 20 years, you would have had a lot of very wealthy Chinese from the mainland coming over either to Canada or to the U.S. or a number of cities in Europe. And they're going to be Mandarin speakers and probably wealthier than any of the other Chinese immigrants that came before them. Have either of you been to any mainland cities?
Not really. I never had the chance. It was more like a fly-by-plane thing. And I never really... it is... I can imagine it's like a New York City with a bunch of Chinese people there. I mean...
Hong Kong a little bit gives you that impression, but Hong Kong is... I don't know. I love the place just because it has this really unique history and... The infrastructure is amazing. I don't know if it's the most densely populated city in the world anymore, but it was at one point. And when you look at the way that it's constructed, it's not flat land, it's mountainous. And so they have all of these hills and mountains that they had to build around. And you have these stunning skyscrapers and other large buildings that are just scattered around this landscape, this very uneven landscape. And all of these complicated twists and turns in the streets and the walkways. And it seems like a miracle that it functions at all, but it functions very well.
Yeah, we did a review of Ghost in the Shell, which is filmed in Hong Kong. And they show you really get a good feel of what the city's like. But I know there's this one scene where... where Scarlett Johansson's character goes and visits her a Japanese mom, but it's in this really amazing apartment complex. It's kind of like this brutalist style architecture, but there's this massive atrium that looks like it's like 60 stories tall, going like straight down. If you've seen that, Peter, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's a very interesting Hong Kong living apartment where it looks like a hive mind or some kind of where boxes are on top of boxes and your room is the size of a hotel room or smaller, and it's just crammed people in there. Very interesting stuff. I wouldn't know. It's probably a very famous place.
I haven't seen the film, but I didn't. So they filmed that in Hong Kong, that new adaptation of Ghost in the Shell?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I think it just opened up in the theaters around here, so I'll have to go check it out. Although I never saw the anime one either, so I think I should watch that one first.
I know a lot of traditionalist types, they tend to kind of hate cities and like extreme density, like extreme vertical living, because they kind of associate those places like New York, San Francisco. And I mean, Hong Kong is far more dense than New York and San Francisco even, but they kind of associate, that's where the diversity and where the parasitic elites are. And I think they have a kind of knee-jerk reaction. And they also kind of, people on the traditionalist right tend to fetishize more living in more small town living, while mainstream conservatives fetishize the car-oriented suburbia. There is something really kind of awe-inspiring about visiting those cities. And the other thing is, it is great, having all your amenities within, a short walking distance and not having to, drive anywhere. What do you think about kind of the concept of a vertical living?
Yeah, I sort of feel halfway in between those two groups that you just mentioned, because on the one hand, I've become much more of a traditionalist as I get older, and seeing the value of older traditions and older ways of doing things. On the other hand, I've always been a city boy, and it just seems to be the environment that I feel at home in. A lot of those criticisms that you mentioned are true, but there is also, that awe-inspiring aspect of cities that, wow, people made this, people came together and they made this place that, if I were creating a world on my own from scratch. I couldn't begin to imagine something as complex as this. But I think you also have to distinguish between different kinds of cities. There was an article that was just published on Taki Mag a couple days ago where the main editor, Taki Theodore Coppolis, I think is how you say his name, he was reminiscing about old New York. And he said, in the old days, New York was a city of neighborhoods. And so every little area had its own character. It was usually built to walking scale so that you had a neighborhood grocery store, a neighborhood clothing store or general store or something. So even though it's a big city and it's this big accumulation of people, it's broken down into little neighborhoods. But if you have a different model where everybody has to have a car and drive everywhere, and people are kind of isolated as individuals rather than being part of a community, that's a very different experience. And I think that's one of the things that's happening in Hong Kong. I think that, and probably a lot of cities all over the world, used to be more human scale, even though they were big cities. And now it's because everything is just more atomized and individualistic, they've lost a lot of that.
There's a lot of different factors. One of them is like the class divides. New York City used to have a large middle class. And I'm not sure if China, in America, like vertical living is more of a luxury thing. In China, do the middle class live in skyscrapers as well, or more kind of mid-rise structures?
It's the norm. I have seen a handful of what you would call houses here in Shenzhen, but they are they're the exceptions to the rule, and they are reserved for the wealthiest of the wealthy. If you want to live in a house that is all yours and you're not sharing this building with other people, you have to be in the top 1%. But everybody lives in a high-rise building. Poor people live in poor quality high-rise buildings. Middle-class people live in slightly nicer high-rise buildings, but it's a city of 15 million people, and that's just the model that they build on.
Yeah, I guess that's just more of an American phenomenon. I mean, I don't know what it is. I guess because in a city like L.A., because there's maybe a limited number and the building costs are much higher, the more expensive to build. I think the other issue is some people have described like high-rises as being like vertical suburbs, in the sense they're kind of, people are kind of cut off, but I guess you could build like a vertical city where people do have a community within that vertical structure. It just has to be done the right way.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's as with so many things, the quality and temperament of the people that you're dealing with determines so much. So one of the conclusions that I came to about political systems or economic systems is that it's not so much the system itself as it is the people involved. And I tend to see human nature as inherently flawed and always it's always going to be wanting for something. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm skeptical about political systems in general, is I think humans have a remarkable way of screwing up just about everything. Which doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, and it doesn't mean that one system isn't better than the other, but there's never going to be a utopia.
I think kind of the libertarian cliche is always that people are good but governments are bad, but I think that's a little bit too simplistic. It doesn't take into account a lot of these flaws in human nature.
Well, I think the thing that gets me about libertarianism is they think of human beings as rational actors. You know, they have this, if we just leave the market alone, people will use their reason and they will make the best deal for themselves. But I don't think you have to spend much time around people to realize that that's just not the way it works. People make most of their decisions based on emotions. They're very quite easily manipulated, unless they learn to develop some kind of critical thinking and guard against that sort of thing. And the market left on its own will just cater to the lowest common denominator. And I think that's increasingly what happens.
There's these kind of philosophies like some people say there's a kind of small is beautiful is one, or big is better. It's more the quality over quantity, like the quality is the key. And talking about these kind of issues like population density and the size of something. It's really about the quality, because something that, like a structure that is well built but that's massive, can be awe-inspiring, but if it's done poorly, it can be a disaster. And I think it's the same as population density. So a lot of people see population density as inherently bad, but I think it if you have bad qualities in the culture, it exacerbates those bad qualities. But if you have good qualities in the culture, it exacerbates those good qualities. So I think it's too simplistic to say that density is inherently bad either.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I notice about cities is that they tend to attract people who are looking to do something big, and who therefore need a large network or a large audience. So traditionally, artists have migrated to cities because they want to break into the art world. They want to make a movie or do something or other. You see a lot of that in Hong Kong. It's a huge city, but they have all kinds of different groups. I was at a filmmakers event a couple weeks ago, and I just heard about it by chance, and so I went and showed up. And it was this really great group of people, and I got to make some new contacts and hand my book out to a few people. And it just occurred to me this wouldn't really happen in Shenzhen, because Shenzhen is too new of a city and they don't have that culture of creativity yet, if they'll ever get it.
Like, there's this stereotype that you hear from certain people on the far right that Asians lack creativity. But I think it's a little bit that's too simplistic, because maybe some cultures value the arts and creativity more than others. And I do remember, like, we were interviewing that artist, Arthur Kwan Lee, who was from a Korean background. And he was saying, like, when he was growing up, like, his family kind of discouraged him, like, not to be an artist, like, to do something more practical, like being a doctor. What have been some of your observations on, like, the art scene in China? Like, is there a growing art scene and creativity in general?
There is a growing art scene, but I don't know how much creativity is involved in it. I think in general, the stereotype that you mentioned is kind of true. I think that China and the West are good examples of how you can take two different philosophies and take them too far. China is very places a lot of emphasis on conformity. And so whether it's in the arts or in other things, the emphasis is always on doing what other people have already done and continuing a tradition. It's a kind of traditionalist attitude, but it's an example of how that attitude can become dead. You know, you just copy the people that came before you and don't try to add anything new. In the West, I think, especially in the modern and postmodern period, you have the opposite, where novelty is praised just for its own sake. You know, oh, this is the newest thing. Well, okay, it's new, but, you know, what is the value of it, really? And so you tend to see in China that problem of too much conformity and not enough creativity. I do hear a lot of Chinese people talking about this and sort of saying, you know, this is something that our culture needs to improve on. This is something that we need to try to emphasize. Here in Shenzhen, one of the things that I've been seeing over the last year is they're placing a lot of emphasis on these things called maker spaces, which I don't know a lot about, but apparently it's something from the tech field where they're like these little workshops where people are supposed to get together and just play with technology, circuit boards and computer chips and whatnot, and try to build new things, build robots or make new inventions. I don't know to what extent it's just the city trying to create an image for itself versus people, you know, really being into this stuff, but we'll see.
That's very important, the whole collective being thing, where especially that the whole Asian mystique is that if you're similar in the arts, you know, that you have to be good as an artist. You have to get it right. Unlike there's this Western tradition, it's about being innovative and new, and especially what we're talking about, free market capitalism, where it seems to be the new product that's always being sold, consumed, whatever. But, you know, in Asian countries, it's rather conformity and rather being good at what you do, precision and the best. Like, there's the difference between, I would think, there's definitely this white interest, this biasedly white people interest towards Japanese is simply because they're easy to convert over to the white side of white liberalism, stuff white people like, as Christian Lander says. It's very easy for a Japanese to admire up-and-coming trends, and the Japanese have their own little, I guess, independent consumerism, which they naively express, and then white people think this happens to be non-whites being a surrogate civilization. They completely disregard any Chinese or Korean background of that, probably because of politics and cultural backgrounding. There's more liberal sympathy with the Japanese. And so there is a lot of unique arts and crafts from Japan. But once again, there is this sad notion of the liberal white person in America putting on their liberal tears or their liberal ideologies upon them, thinking that they're white like them, right? Recently, I saw it in theaters, was Your Name, which is a very popular anime right now in Japan. It's very popular within the Japanese, and I guess Funimation thought it was a good idea to put it in American audiences, so I guess white Americans could experience quote-unquote authentic culture, when in return, it doesn't. It's really Japanese at heart and has deep Shinto philosophy. And so the only thing the white American could do would say, he can make up this fib and say it has to do with feminism, social justice warriorism, you know, this whole gender neutral thing and about some progressive notion, right? That is a completely white person made up thing. The same way when they watch Akira and Ghost in the Shell and whatever cyberpunk animes in the 90s, white people seem to put on these tags that they like, that's in their culture, but it really doesn't represent the other Japanese side of the things. And so, not to sound like a pessimist, I feel like there's always been this kind of white naivety when other whites go into other countries and they assume they want to be like them. It's either you assimilate to that side, you're this side, but you're never this third position, you know? And that's kind of my witty observations from it. But I do see this weird third position, especially in, I guess, in the area of New York City and Philadelphia, where you have both whites and Asians colliding together, and they're trying to find this weird pan-Asian American thing. I wouldn't know how to describe it, but I think there can be a third position between agreeing, but it seems to be always one-sided, either whitewashed or Asian-washed or whatever.
I've definitely noticed in America a lot of idealization of Asian cultures, whether it's Japanese or Chinese. You go into the bookstore and there's a big area on exactly. Buddhism and Taoism, and you can read translations of Confucius and everything. And all of that stuff is great, but people tend to think that that's what the civilization is all exactly. about, even today. And, you know, the reality is that you're not going to find that any more than you're going to find Jesus and the apostles in the West. You know, like, that is the tradition and that is the ideal of that culture.
A good example would be, you know, if somebody was to pick up a Penguin's classic of Basho's haikus, all written in English without Japanese, Jack Kerouac had his own silly cut-and-paste haikus, because I think Japanese should be read, haikus should be read by Japanese, Romaji, Hiragana, and then the English. If it's just straight-up English, you're going to have, like, Jack Kerouac read his own haikus, which seems to give justification of this strange postmodernism, I want to do whatever I want because it's decadent art feeling. And like you're just right. saying, it's this strange thing that just cannot be translated, and there's high expectations of the culture.
Well, and I noticed also that it tends to the people who are into those things, Buddhism and Taoism and the traditional cultures of the East, they tend to knowingly or not graft it onto the 1960s liberal ideas that they already had before they got into that stuff. And so, like you were saying before, they automatically assume that all of those people would agree with their liberal politics. And it's just kind of absurd, especially when you look at the Japanese, who have had this long militaristic tradition. And,
exactly.
Many of the spiritual traditions, even, they can be quite harsh. And that's, you know, it's like...
Yeah, it's really upsetting.
This hippie guy is saying, like, yeah, I'm into Zen, man. And it's like, well, it's really wish the Zen master would come and hit you with a stick, because that's what those guys do.
It's upsetting because there's a whole department called Asian Studies ruled by just... whites trying to understand it in a white perspective, and it really loses the tradition of some of the foundations of Asian studies, and it's just really annoying to come by some upper
like
class.
Like, well, it's like, well, basically LARPing or just exactly. Like flat-out dilettantism, where people do stuff because they like the cool image of it, but they're not really serious about the ideas.
Yeah, just reference.
I think there's been a spiritual vacuum in the West for quite some time now, for complicated reasons. I mean, part of it is the collapse of Christianity over at least 300 years, and more recently the things that happened in the 1960s. But I noticed that people tend to be there's a lot of people who are, I don't know, searchers, maybe you could call them, like they're aware at some level that they have this need for basically a religious tradition, and they're not finding it in their native land. And so they go to the bookstore and they, you know, they go to the New Age area, or they go to the Asian studies area, or they go to whatever. And you're seeing more and more of these people branching out. And there's a number of problems with that. Number one, because they don't have any grounding in their native traditions, because they've had a bad education, they didn't learn anything about the history of Greco-Roman philosophy or the Christian tradition or any of it. And then they encounter Buddhism or something else and they go, wow, this is really profound. And it is really profound, but they're not aware of the fact that the Western tradition has actually addressed a lot of these same issues and come up with our own unique solutions or ways of dealing with them over time. And the other thing, too, is then that there's this culture of self-denial and self-hatred that has come from the last 75 years or so. And so people misinterpret a lot of these Eastern doctrines based on that. And I have a largely negative experience of people in the West who are into Eastern studies.
Exactly.
Keeping in mind that I came from that background myself, and so I you know, include myself in that group and criticize my own past.
You said you were from a philosophical background. Which philosophers had the biggest impact on you?
Well, oddly enough, one of the first things that I read that I thought had a really strong impact on me was an English translation of the Tao Te Ching, the book from Lao Tzu. And I read that when I was, I don't know, maybe a teenager or in my early 20s. And before that, I had been studying philosophy at school. And I really liked the intro classes where you read some of the classics, you read some of Plato's dialogues, and even going into some of the skeptics like Hume. And I could relate to those guys because their language was rather clear, and I thought that they were dealing with real issues. And so then I thought, okay, I'll major in philosophy. This is something that I like. And I started studying more recent people like the existentialists and the postmodernists. And when I read those guys, it was really disappointing to see that Western philosophy somehow went from Plato and Marcus Aurelius to Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault. And, you know, like, what the hell happened here?
These fucking shitheads. It's because it all started with Martin Heidegger. Martin Heidegger was the last philosopher who tried to put the East in the West. And somehow the word deconstruction, which he used, meant to be hostile. And people like Paul de Man, who was pretty much a classical fascist, and then all of a sudden became using it for bad means. And I totally hate the French fuckers, and and I don't consider them any worth of values. I think Martin Heidegger was the last Western philosopher who was trying to give, like you were just saying, this Eastern philosophy with a Western take. And I think even the undergrad schools refuse to say Martin's name. It's just it's crazy.
Yeah, I've been meaning, Heidegger is another one of those people who is on my list of thinkers that I need to read and engage. His work is kind of daunting. Every time I pick up one of his texts and try to dig into it, it's like, oh, I'm going to need to devote some serious time and effort to this guy. But you said that, did he actually invent the word deconstruction? I didn't know
that. Well, that's the thing. It's an old word that, if you know, he used it in a way that if you were to root back to the authenticity of the word, he used it in a very strange word. You can find it. But the word was first tainted by Paul de Man, where he said, well, you know, the ideal is there's these different waves of deconstruction. It really is a terrible thing. I don't like deconstruction. But the ideal was supposed to be that, well, accordingly, deconstruction in the ways of Paul de Man was basically the ideal that if these dumb people are writing history, you have the power to, you know, the power to deconstruct it. And then there's the second wave where it's like, well, William Shakespeare, he's not really a god figure. He's just an average person. You have to deconstruct that. And then you have Derrida's social justice warrior deconstruction, where it's nothing matters at all, and you have to deconstruct things that are racist. And you understand where the word, how foul deconstruction is, and it really ticks me off at times. Whenever I hear that word in a sentence, I feel that someone has a left-wing agenda, no matter what.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's you cut out there for a moment, so I don't know if you mentioned this already, but oftentimes in academia, you'll find people who are into Zen or Buddhism, and they'll interpret it within a deconstructionist context. You know, they'll saying like, oh, well, Buddhism is the deconstruction of the self, which it kind of is, but it's not. They're imputing these meanings from this very recent development, aberration in Western philosophy, onto this very old tradition from literally the other side of the world.
I think the greatest band, or, you know, I had a project on deconstruction in my school. I remember doing it on deconstruction, and I basically presented a negative view on deconstruction. And I said that if I was to put random letters of literature from Jim Goad to, you know, Peter Sotos, and just put them in these letters and send them out to every student and tell you that the text does not matter, even though how shocking and hardcore it is. That is the value of deconstruction, because you are going beyond the text and assuming that nothing matters, and you have to look at it as the text. And of course, I it was a very controversial thing I did in my presentation on DM.
Put out like links to Sotos to the other students.
Well, yeah, and I was teaching.
What is it? His Paul like DeMann's most deconstruction, his most obscene work?
No, just lyrics of White House, Crawl Like a Fucking Eel, like stuff like that, right?
Oh,
because the thing is, the point is that deconstructions just want you to do is look at the text as nothing at all, no matter how shocking it may be. I can give you what Ted Kaczynski has read. I can give you what Yukio Mishima has written. I can give you the naughty, dirty letters what James Joyce has written, his porn letters, and then assume it doesn't matter. Deconstruction says this is just free. You're deconstructing, you know. And I also put out Atari Teenage Riot lyrics the same way, because I think if there was music, deconstruction as music would be Atari Teenage Riot. And so I guess my teacher hated it. He called me a point blank on it. And I argued with him. And this guy had Marxist feminist agendas. And I don't know. When I was somebody, but another professor told me it was great what I was doing. And it just shows you how biased teaching deconstruction is. It's really pathetic. It's an avant-garde excuse to basically make creative writing an academic discipline. That's pretty much what it is.
To me, the deconstruction is usually selective deconstruction. You know, they want you to deconstruct traditional values, but
exactly.
They don't want you to deconstruct the values that are implicit in their own worldview. And so if you start to go after those, that's when you're going to get in trouble.
Yeah, they have their own, like, all these things that
are
sacred.
You can't deconstruct
like
a deconstructionist. And then it's like, that's pathetic, because a deconstruction will finally blow himself up because he's... And I think the alt-right is
I think one of the biggest misconceptions about the cultural left is that they're, like, a nihilist or moral relativist. They have their own, like, religious-type view. Like, it's like a secular religion of their hierarchy of what's sacred. So a lot of conservatives and even alt-right types ran about them being a nihilist or moral relativist. I mean, that's not accurate at all.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that, because they have this religious fervor that just wouldn't make sense if they were truly nihilists. Or I think they're clinging to these beliefs as if it were a religion, but it's not, and it can't be. And so they probably vacillate between a kind of fundamentalism and nihilism in the moments when that belief system breaks down and doesn't, you know, fulfill them.
As far as writers go, were you influenced by the beat writers like Burroughs and Kerouac?
Yeah, actually, I was going to mention before when you were talking about cities and, you know, the contrast between cities and towns, it wasn't really an influence on my writing, but it's a book that I like a lot. The very first book that Jack Kerouac ever wrote was The Town and the City. And it's unlike his later works because it doesn't have any of the sort of, you know, spontaneous poetics, playfulness, which some people like and some people don't. It's just a straightforward narrative. And it's the story of his family basically growing up in a small town, and then he moves to the city, to New York City. And most people who are into Kerouac only like it for the second half, because it's got his first writings about the liveliness of Times Square and, you know, coming into the city from afar and seeing all the lights and all of that. But the novel as a whole is a really interesting contrast, and a very conservative contrast between life in the town and life in the city. And he ultimately draws some negative conclusions about city life. And I think most people who are into Kerouac these days don't really realize that that's where he was coming from. And if you look at all of his works, you can see this constant contrast or fight, you know, between the part of him that was kind of a, you know, a dissolute, and the part of him that wanted to get back to that smaller town life that he came from. But in terms of influences on my writing style, I think some of the minimalist writers who usually get lumped under the title of dirty realism, people like Raymond Carver, John Fanta, somebody mentioned Flannery O'Connor, who I hadn't actually read until after I finished my book, but I just started reading her now, and I guess I have some similarities with her as well.
Flannery O'Connor, I would say, is somewhat of a right-wing author, even though in academia they refuse to talk about it. I remember having a project on Flannery O'Connor, and she had really nothing nice to say about those brown people, and actually about and a lot of her stories are really just about segregation and about following. But a lot of people have been, I guess, deconstructing, or at least saying that there's a value to it, and it's really hard to I remember doing a 10-page report just being angry and saying how Flannery O'Connor is basically the values that go against any liberal point of view. But yeah, there's a lot of good wisdom, a lot of conservative wisdom from O'Connor.
And she was a devout Catholic, and so, and you know, this is pre-Vatican II days, and so how could she not be, by today's standards, a far right-wing author?
Exactly.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add about some of the themes in your novel?
No, I think that should do it for now. I've really enjoyed talking to you guys, so I appreciate the opportunity to be on. And if anybody wants to check out my book, you can find it on Amazon. Just look for Paradise Theater by Jack Ravenwood. You can also go to the publisher website, a small book company that I run called littleapepress.com. And yeah, please check it out.
And as far as your upcoming projects go, you said you've actually thought about documenting like the neon signs in Hong Kong, kind of like how Thomas Rinaldi does in New York with his blog on New York Neon.
I would like to do that. It's all dependent on time. I'm juggling a few different projects right now, and I'm also trying to figure out what I'm going to do for my next writing project. I finished this book at the end of last year, and then I took some time off to try to generate some new ideas and just catch up on my reading. And so I'm trying to figure out what my next either collection of short stories or maybe a novel will be. And then I have some other things that I'm working on as well. So it's still up in the air, but I do hope to do that neon signage project maybe sometime in the next 6 months.
Yeah, or you could do like a coffee table book of that.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. And I just, if nothing else, I would just like to document it before it's gone, because I don't know how much longer that stuff is going to be around.
As far as your articles, have you had some of your articles published on major sites? I think one of them was on the Oons Review.
Yeah, that's right. I wrote an article, I think it was last month, comparing the Trump presidency as it was then to John F. Kennedy's presidency. And so I sent that to Ron Unz, and he was gracious enough to publish it on his website. So my miscellaneous articles are collected at a blog called Foreigner Thoughts, and so people can check that out as well. And I mostly just try to collect my thoughts on life, expat life here in China, other miscellaneous observations in philosophy or politics, I've been actually, we were talking about postmodernists before, and one of the only postmodernists that I have any abiding interest in is Jean Baudrillard, just because his ideas, whether you like them or not, seem to be more and more relevant as time goes on. Especially, so, Pillaterhead, did you read Baudrillard at all when you were studying guys?
I love the simulacrum theory about how, you know, the McDonald's cheeseburger that are you really ordering a quote-unquote cheeseburger, or is it a thing to make up as a cheeseburger, and you're consuming the ideal that it is a cheeseburger? Yeah, I do like some of his stuff, especially simulacrum theory.
Oh, yeah. And, I remember that story when he was commissioned to be a journalist to go document the Gulf War, and he said, like, what's the point? I can just – it's all a simulation. I can just, like, document it from my TV screen.
Exactly. You know, society is a Discord server. You know, your tranny boyfriend, is that really a girl or just a guy dressed up as a girl? A lot of Bill Labard's his theories can be used to benefit, really, to threaten or be extreme skeptic of society. But, yeah, there is wisdom to his super doubt Philip K. Dickian theories, but, yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend reading him in isolation, but he can be very useful and very entertaining, if nothing else.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Jack Ravenwood for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Thank you both for having me on. I really enjoyed talking to you.
And also, thanks, Pillater.
It's nice talking to you guys, like always.